Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori on this Saturday morning, October 12th. How are we doing this morning? Kind of a cloudy, dark day, but hope you're feeling sunny and bright on this October weekend. 55 degrees. Going to get to a high of 65 today out here on the East End. Cloudy, but hey, it's autumn. It's kind of cool, this weather. I know it's my birthday month. Had a great B-Day earlier in the week. And thank you to all who wished me happy birthday on social media, Facebook, Instagram, all that jazz. And it's an exciting month out here on the East End, as it's the Hamptons International Film Festival. Always fascinated by the variety of films they bring out here, and so many that go on to win Oscars and, you know, just major awards. And this morning we will talk to two individuals who have films in this festival, two very different films indeed. And one premiered last night. Mark Lanzmann directed Scandalous, the true story of the National Enquirer. Not too involved with sports, but I'm sure they've, you know, uncovered some scandal in sports through the years. But, you know, since I'm in the media, I just found this film to just be fascinating. And it charts the origins and the influence of this infamous supermarket tabloid, the tabloid that former editor-in-chief Steve Koz called the National Enquirer. He called it the most perfectly placed piece of propaganda in America. It reveals the film how the paper carefully capitalized on the celebrity fascinations of the average American and combined that with just ruthless, sometimes immoral, methods that its reporters would use to get the story at all costs. And look, I've been in the media for many, many years, and seeing this film shocked me. A lot of the material in this film even shocked me after, knowing, a bit about what goes on, particularly at that kind of publication. Just crazy stuff. So we'll talk with Mark Lanzmann, the director of Scandalous, the true story of the National Enquirer. Get his insight on the whole publication and just the damage, really, it has done, I think, in our country and in our world, this kind of journalism. You can't even call it journalism, right? But that's debatable, I guess. And then in the second half of the show, actually for the second straight week, we're going to talk to producer, writer, director Gay Polsky. Now, last week, we talked about Red Penguins, which is also debuting this weekend here at the Hamptons International Film Festival. We spoke about, the film. It's a really interesting. I mean, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Pittsburgh Penguins, National Hockey League team, and the famed Red Army hockey team. They joined formed a joint venture, and basically bought this team. And they hired this guy, Steve Warsaw, this eccentric marketing whiz, to go to Moscow and basically promote this team and get fans in the seats, which they ended up doing. But the film is all about, what is going on behind the scenes. It was a very lawless period, and so much was going on, from just murders that went unsolved to all these people making fortunes. And there were no rules there. There were no laws there. I don't know, if it's changed since then, but it's really all about this hockey team and how it thrived for a short period of time with all this stuff going on in Russia, and how the Pittsburgh Penguins were involved in the ownership of it. But the film that most intrigued me, that Gabe produced, wrote, and directed, Red Penguins is great. That was very intriguing. But he also did this film called In Search of Greatness, revealing the true nature of the greatest athletes of all time. And he had intimate conversations with a number of just superstar athletes, from Wayne Gretzky to Jerry Rice to Pele. And so Gabe is going to come into the studio. Hope he finds us this morning. And in the second half of the show, we will talk to Gabe right here in person about both of these films. So I'm looking forward to that. Let's see. In sports, well, game one of the American League Championship Series featuring the Yankees and the Astros tonight. Astros having home field advantage by earning the best record in Major League Baseball. They needed five games, though, to dispose of the Tampa Bay Rays in the division series. And meanwhile, the Yankees swept the Twins last week, just dominating Minnesota. So the best of seven series between the Cardinals and the Nationals started last evening at Busch Stadium. Nationals blanking the Cardinals 2-0 in what was the Nationals' first appearance in the National League Championship Series. Sanchez taking a no-hitter into the eighth inning at Busch Stadium. He didn't allow a hit until his 103rd pitch when there were two outs in the eighth. Pinch hitter Jose Martinez, he lined a single to center. And Sanchez's final line, 7 2/3 innings pitched, one hit, no runs, one walk, five strikeouts, and two hit batters. So that's what's happening in the postseason. Two of the biggest names in men's tennis, Roger Federer and Novak Djokovic, losing in the quarterfinals of the Shanghai Masters. Federer lost to Alexander Zverev in three sets. He actually received a code violation for hitting a ball into the stands, and then he received a point penalty for unsportsmanlike conduct after flicking a ball into the air when trailing 3-love in the third set. Wow, very un-Federer-like. Djokovic, the defending champion, lost to Stefanos Tsitsipas in three sets. Medvedev faces Tsitsipas in today's semifinals. And if Medvedev wins, he could advance to a sixth straight tournament final. All right, those are the headlines. And when we come back, we are going to talk to director Mark Landsman about Scandalous, the untold story of the National Enquirer, which had its premiere last night. But first, let me tell you that Sports Interview with Ann Liguori is brought to you in part by Dune Jewelry and my Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. Visit Dune Jewelry, DUNEJewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, unmatched clarity, change your game. P-E-A-K Vision.com. I know you won't be there. Every time I turn around, you disappear. Nice to meet you. The following is a public service announcement from WPPB. The next North Fork Art District Tour will take place on Sunday, October 27th, with an immersive day of contemporary artworks, including tours of the Alex Ferrone Gallery, William Riss Gallery, and the studios of Max Moran, Scott McIntyre, and Laurie Hollander. Meet artists, view exciting exhibits, and watch creative demonstrations. The tour finishes at the Halyard Restaurant in Greenport, with a pairing dinner featuring Lens Wines and a live art auction. Tickets at northforknow.org.
I'm Meg Noonan, host of Freeform Radio, inviting you to join me every Sunday from 6 until 8 p.m. for a lively mix of rock in all its glorious subgenres, including but never limited to classic rock and roll, American and British blues, glam and garage, punk and new wave, indie, folk, and country, plus a heavy dose of soul, funk, R&B, and more. So tune into Freeform Radio, where variety reigns supreme, every Sunday night at 6 on 88.3 WPPB.
The following is a public service announcement from 88.3 WPPB. Founded in 1987, The Retreat is a nonprofit licensed domestic violence agency. It provides a number of services to help break the cycle of family violence. The Retreat offers a secure residence on the east end of Long Island and works with local, state, and national agencies to provide a safe haven, food, clothing, and support. More information at theretreatinc.org or 631-329-4398.
Join us for Sundays on the East End with Bridget Leroy and Alex Sokolow, a free-flowing conversation with musicians, magicians, artists, writers, scientists, and other local people who cast their own interesting shadows across the East End. Like us on Facebook to see who's coming up on Sundays on the East End with Bridget Leroy and Alex Sokolow every Sunday at 11 a.m. here on 88.3 WPPB-FM, Long Island's only NPR station.
365 days a year, WPPB is working for you on the air and on our website. WPPB has a helpful community calendar on our site. Just go to 883WPPB.org to the Community Calendar tab and tell us about your activity or event. It's free, easy, and fast. WPPB is the voice of the community, 365 days a year, 7 days a week, on the air and online. Spread the word about your community events. Go to 883WPPB.org.
Hi, I'm Gianna Volpe. I play music that rocks, invite you to East End events that rule, and talk with people all over our Twin Forks on The Heart of the East End, 9 to noon, Mondays through Fridays, on Long Island's only NPR station, 88.3 FM, WPPB, or online at 883WPPB.org.
Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann LaGorry on this Saturday morning. So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. And you can hear us from anywhere online at 883WPPB.org. And each show is archived at AnnLaGorry.com. And each show is turned into a podcast as well, where you can hear it anytime. And joining me this morning, Mark Landsman, director of Scandalous, the true story of the National Enquirer. Mark, good morning. Welcome to Sports Interview.
Good morning. Great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. How did it go last night, the premiere?
We had a great time. It went really well. It's a great festival.
Yeah, the Hamptons International Film Festival going on this weekend. And, I watched the film, and it's just fascinating. Here I've been in the media for so many years, and I learned so much and was really shocked by a lot that was in this film, Mark. You know, it's a complex subject to tackle in a relatively short period of time, to cover the origin and most of the scandals that took place throughout the history of the publication. Yet I thought you and your team did an excellent job in, really getting much of the top stories and scandals that took place during, that certain period of time in the film, right? That must have been difficult.
Thank you. Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was about 50 years of history packed into a feature film, so it was a lot. And, you have to make decisions about which stories that you focus on, which ones you have to sort of let go to the cutting room floor. But, the media stories were the ones that we really, the ones that were really the big blockbuster stories were the ones we focused on. The ones that sort of defined each era of the Enquirer.
I mean, how difficult was that in organizing the approach and, what was the process like? I'm always interested in the process of what you decide to include in this period, in this film.
I think we really, like you said, there's thousands of stories that the Enquirer did, and I think we wanted to choose the ones that were, in a lot of ways, the most controversial, the most scandalous, and the ones that also revealed the tactics that these guys used. I mean, these guys were a combination of, spies, and, they employed espionage, they used bribes, there were all kinds of unconventional tactics that they used that mainstream journalists would be fired for. And we wanted to look at the stories where those things were used to the extreme. So, for example, the death of Elvis Presley and what they did, basically that trumped all the other media in terms of getting the kind of coverage of that event that they got. Of course, you know, the John Belushi case going into the 80s, Gary Hart, you know, Elvis, I mean, OJ, excuse me, and the Princess Diana, all of these things. Those were, we really wanted to, that's how we chose the stories.
Yeah, I mean, for Elvis, for instance, they just sent about, what, 20, 25 reporters. They set up shop right there in Memphis, and they wanted to get the photograph, the first photograph of Elvis basically in the coffin.
In the coffin,
so describe a little bit, if you would, for our listeners, how they went about that, because it was crazy.
Yeah, I mean, well, the one thing is that money was no object for the Inquirer founder, Jerusalem Pope. So when something happened and he wanted that story, he would just pump whatever resources were required to get that story. So in the case of Elvis Presley, I think the news came into the office in Florida where the Inquirer was based that Elvis had died, and within the hour, five Inquirer reporters were on a Learjet to Memphis, and they set up, they bought out an entire floor of a Holiday Inn. They brought in fax machines and typewriters and everything, and then they brought in more staff. They had about $50,000 in cash on them, and they bought out everybody. They just basically bought up a bunch of sources, and they had a singular mission, which is that they wanted to be the first publication in the world to get a photograph of Elvis Presley lying in state in his coffin. The family had prohibited photographs, and they were very, I mean, it was like a lockdown operation, but they managed to get an Inquirer reporter snuck into the line and dressed as a priest with a camera in his robes. And that failed. And the rest, I hope people will come to the audience to see, but they actually end up getting the photograph. Right? And how they score the photograph is one of the film's kind of great moments in terms of anecdotes.
It really,
it's, I mean, really nuts.
It's just nuts. Totally. They pay off everybody. I mean, and what's so ironic about what, you know, the film, I think you interview a lot of the reporters and editors. Yeah. They were extremely honest on camera for this film. And you could see they were torn between loving the place and hating it. They were so dedicated to getting the story, pleasing the owner, making the money, because as you pointed out in the film, you know, the people there, they got a lot of reporters that came from the UK who were more experienced with that, quote, tabloid mentality. And but yet they, I guess they paid them a lot more than most newspapers around the country.
Almost triple.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, one of the funniest things in the film is that one of the reporters says that, you know, at the time he was making twice as much as Ben Bradley, who was the editor of the Washington Post at the time of Watergate.
Wow.
You know, so.
Yeah, but they were
that guy's underpaid.
They were so, they were apologetic that in most cases, these reporters that were on film and the editors, that they went too far. But yet you could see they had a deep passion for what they were doing, right?
Yeah, you know, that was the thing about the film. You know, I mean, we wanted to create a film that was an honest look at what it was like to be a reporter at the most notorious tabloid in the world. You know, that was really our objective. You know, we set out to tell an honest story about what these guys were like. Who did this paper attract? Who would go to work for the Inquirer? What it was like. And what was required of these guys. And you talk to any of these guys, and some of them, you know, men and women, both, some of them went on to have incredible careers, you know, at even mainstream outlets, or other, some people went on to other things like publishing. But all of them say that time working at the Inquirer is where they cut their teeth, because it was intensely competitive. It was a very insecure position. There was no job security. You could be fired for looking at someone the wrong way. Secretaries were fired because General Sopoke didn't like their fragrance. I mean, it was a very ruthless environment. Basically, every single Friday, they would have this situation that they called the Friday Night Massacre, where basically they would all assemble and they would have a big party, but then a pink slip would be handed out at the end of the night and somebody would be fired. It was not an easy environment. Reporter after reporter said that nobody would buy a nice car because you never knew if you were going to have a parking spot the next week.
Wow.
Very few people invested in houses. It was really, they were adrenaline junkies. They loved, you know, they were obviously, you know, the money was great, the travel was great, and that, you know, you were constantly pushed to go further and further and further. But that also took its toll. I mean, both on them and, I think you could say, also on us.
Sure.
for a lot of reasons.
And I want to get into that in a second. But I mean, the film spotlights several instances in which, you know, the National Enquirer had the story before anybody else, and yeah. And then a lot of other instances where celebrities would pay them hush money, you know, to the powers to be, that they killed a story, like from Cosby to Bob Hope, Arnold, you know, and in fact, Arnold was on the board of American Media. I mean, it's just shocking, yeah. You know, conflicts.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can really, it's interesting, you know, the idea of catch and kill is a more contemporary idea that really started much later in the current era of the paper and AMI. But the idea of trade outs, what you just described, where a celebrity's publicist might, the Enquirer, the way that it would go is that an Enquirer would get a story. They would find out, you know, you mentioned Bob Hope, for example. So one of the people in the film had broken a story about Bob Hope that was very negative and very damaging to his reputation. And she brought that story into her editors, and the editors would then determine whether or not that story was beneficial to selling papers or detrimental to selling papers. In the case of Bob Hope, at the time, you know, we're talking about in the 70s, you know, Bob Hope was America's favorite comedian at that time. And he was on USO tours. So, you know, the powers that be made the decision, well, do we really want to print this information about Bob Hope right now? Or can we go back to Bob Hope's publicist and say, hey, we've got this information on Mr. Hope. We know it's true because we have this, that, and the other. Because they had sources. The one thing that it's important to understand is, like, the sources, they had sources everywhere. They were a spy network. So they had sources in beauty parlors and hospitals and especially in families. People's own families would turn on them, and they would be on the Enquirer payroll. So the Enquirer then had this ability to sort of broker information with a publicist. So, you know, if you don't want us to publish this information about Mr. Hope, what else you got? And the publicist would say, look, we'll give you an exclusive. You can come and be with the Hopes for Christmas, or you can be at the Thanksgiving dinner, or you'll come and ride a golf cart with Bob, and, you know, we'll talk about something other than the thing that you want to publish. And that's how it would go. And it went that way for a long time. And it's only until the paper started to kind of dabble in politics that it got that got much more nefarious and much stickier.
As you dove into this with your research, Mark, I mean, were you shocked, or were you kind of expecting what you uncovered?
That's such a good question. I wasn't shocked, but I was really fascinated with sort of the pattern and how, you know, these practices that we're seeing now on the front pages of our newspapers and on every, you know, the stuff that we're talking about right now today with catch and kill, just how it kind of evolved. That was the thing. It was so fascinating. This paper started out kind of seemingly harmless, right? Just sort of as a form of escapism for the average American to not have to deal with the horrors of Vietnam and gas lines and inflation and Watergate, all these things that were really, you know, racial issues in the cities. There were so many things going on in the 70s. And Mr. Pope creates this paper as a kind of a diversion from that. And to watch how that thing transforms and morphs into what it would become, which was a piece of political propaganda, was fascinating. So I would say that I wasn't shocked, but I was more like, oh my God, you know, this is an incredible story. And it's really kind of a story of us in a way, you know, it's sort of a window into who we are as Americans. So I thought that was really interesting.
Right. I mean, the premise being that your average American just loves to read this stuff, right? Are they believing it, or they're just reading it just for the entertainment value? I mean,
well, you know, there's a woman, you know, one of the funniest lines. I don't want to give away one of the funniest lines of the movie, but you know, it's really, you know, the answer is yes. You know, I think that's the tricky. That's the tricky thing about the Enquirer is that, you know, you would have stories of, you know, alien landings in Roswell, and, you know, Gene Dixon predicting, you know, this, that, and the other thing, and, you know, Liz Taylor's weight gain, and Seventh Husband, and all this stuff, Lonnie Anderson and Burt Reynolds, you know, next to stories that were sort of looked like they were legitimate news stories. So, you know, the reader was kind of confused. Not confused, but you're getting information, and how do you determine what's true and
that's
what's
right.
false? What, you know, it all starts to get mixed up. And that's why I think the paper started to be considered a threat to mainstream journalism, you know, particularly when you get into the realm of politics. Because, so what do you do? You know, is this a news report, or is this gossip? And if it's gossip, is it true? You know, or is it hearsay? And I think that's what the film attempts to sort of, you know, we really wanted to present more questions than answers in the film. Because, you know, even after having spent a year and a half on the film, the filmmakers, we still have questions. You know, it's kind of complicated.
Well, you know, for instance, personally, I wouldn't go near it. I would feel like
right.
it's so dirty. It's like, if I, you know, you don't know what's true. You don't know what, there's such a blur of the between truth and fiction, and it just sets such a dangerous precedent.
But, you know, you say you don't go near it, right? But what's so fascinating, and what I think was so, what another thing that really drew us to make the film is that, you know, whether or not you read The Inquirer or The Star or The Examiner or World Weekly News, you to this day cannot help seeing it as an impression, because back in 1972, in the early stages of The Inquirer, Mr. Pope recognized that there was a piece of real estate in America that hundreds of millions of Americans went to every single week without fail, and that was the grocery store. And he bought up that real estate. So when you look at your magazine racks now at the front end of your grocery store, whether or not you choose to pick up that paper or not, you're glancing at an Inquirer headline. You're seeing a headline that says that this politician has, you know, actually grows antennas out of her head, you know, and is an alien. You know, or you're seeing that, you know, she has, you know, 5 months to live when she's perfectly healthy, or, and that this other one is fantastic, you know, and you're not realizing it while you're sitting there holding your Cheerios or whatever you're doing, but it makes an impression on you, you know. So Steve Koz, who was the editor of the paper for years and quite an intelligent guy, you know, he says, you know, there's no difference between that and a billboard in Times Square. You know, it's free advertising. And so when you have a political
message... Well, that's a stretch. But go ahead.
Well, I mean, it's you cannot help but see a cover of an Inquirer.
Right.
You know, you see a picture, you see a headline, and, you know, oftentimes you'll pick it up.
Right. Oh, sure. And they're so good at that strategy. They're so good at what they do. So how are they doing now? Mark, how's the National Enquirer doing now?
Not well in terms of circulation. I mean, circulation that, well, obviously, I mean, we know that David Pecker has immunity and is involved in, you know, this catch and kill case is unfolding before our eyes. Mm-hmm. And how, in terms of business, circulation is really at an all-time low, but the paper was just sold for $100 million.
Right.
And was bought by a group of investors. So we'll see what happens. I mean, who knows what they're going to do with it. It certainly will never be the same as it was in its heyday.
And you captured that heyday so well. I mean, seriously, it's an excellent film. Congratulations.
Thank
it
you.
Opens in theaters November 15th. You have another screening this weekend, right?
We do, Sunday at 8:30 in East Hampton.
In East Hampton.
Yes,
Sunday.
United Artists.
All right, Sunday, 8:30, Sunday evening, 8:30, East Hampton. I highly recommend people see it. It's you'll have a rude awakening. And it's disturbing yet fascinating. And I thought you and your team did a fabulous job with it, Mark. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
All right, have a great weekend. Enjoy the Hamptons International Film Festival.
Thank you. Take care.
Mark Landsman, director of Scandalous, the true story of the National Enquirer. Wow. Good to see you, Gabe.
How you doing?
Gabe is in the house. We're going to take a quick break and come back, and we'll get back to sports. I mean, since I've been in the media all these years, I thought I really want to – I don't know if you've seen – you have to see this film. This film about the National Enquirer was quite I don't know what to say about it, but, you know, having been in the media for so long, even I was shocked to see some of the practices that these journalists and editors would use to get the story. It was quite disturbing. But anyway, we're going to go back to sports and talk to Gabe Holster, who wrote, directed, and produced a film that's being shown this weekend, which we talked about last week, Red Penguins.
Yeah.
But In Search of Greatness is very similar to really my legacy of sports interviews. So I'm so delighted to talk to you about it. And I was able to watch it last night, In Search of Greatness, although it came out, in 2018. So we're going to talk to writer, director, producer Gabe Polsky right after I tell you that Sports Interview with Ann LaGoria is brought to you in part by Dune Jewelry and my Hamptons Robe Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. DuneJewelry.com. And by Peak Vision sunglasses, zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game. PeakVision.com. When you smile,
join us for Sundays on the East End with Bridget Leroy and Alex Sokolow, a free-flowing conversation with musicians, magicians, artists, writers, scientists, and other local people who cast their own interesting shadows across the East End. Like us on Facebook to see who's coming up on Sundays on the East End with Bridget Leroy and Alex Sokolow every Sunday at 11 a.m. here on 88.3 WPPB-FM, Long Island's only NPR station.
You've got the best seats in the house for the greatest songs of the American musical theater. Hello, I'm your host, Larry Maslon, for Broadway to Main Street here on WPPB. Curtain goes up every Sunday at 3 o'clock.
Broadway to Main Street, you pass.
Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann LaGoria on this Saturday morning. So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. And you can hear us from anywhere on the planet, online at 883WPPB.org. Each show's archived at AnnLaGoria.com and distributed on podcasts. And it's Hamptons International Film Festival weekend. And joining me live in the studio is somebody participating in the festival, Gabe Holsky, who we talked to last week over the phone. Where were you?
I was in New York.
Oh, you were in New York. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Chicago.
You're a Midwestern guy.
I grew up in Chicago area.
Somebody just tweeted me when they saw that, you know, that my promo on Twitter and said they played hockey with you in high school.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, I don't want to hear those stories.
Were you an athlete?
I was a funny... Yeah. I played Division I hockey at Yale.
Oh, you did?
But
okay.
I was kind of an unorthodox guy.
Well, that's... In Search of Greatness, that's what it's all about, being unorthodox,
right? Yeah, that's true. You're right.
So hockey was your sport?
Yeah, it was my sport, yeah.
Awesome.
I mean, I liked all sports, but yeah, at a certain point, you got focus on one thing.
Exactly. But In Search of Greatness, one of the themes is that, and I always believe this, is that all these great athletes, whether it was Wayne Gretzky, who you interviewed, or Pele, or Jerry Rice, John McEnroe, obviously, he played soccer, he played baseball, you know, just instead of pursuing that one sport solely as a child, you know, the variety of sports is so important.
It's
crucial. And it contributes to greatness if, you know, if somebody takes it to that level, don't you think? I mean, that was
absolutely
one of the
keys.
I mean,
you have to develop different aspects of your mind and your body and sort of how you process information. And if you're just, you can't have a wide breadth of tools if you're only, you know, doing one thing. You know, you've got to bring so many different aspects of life and physicality, even studying kind of martial arts. Pelé in the movie talks about how he studied martial arts. I believe personally that, like, every young athlete should study jiu-jitsu, you know, because the way that you grapple, the way that you understand your body and other people's momentum and leverage and force and you know, how to roll with sort of checks and hits.
Right.
And, you know, it's all stuff that you can use and just make you kind of a more interesting and in-depth athlete. Gretzky talks about baseball, how it, right. You know, it's so you have to think ahead and sort of think about all the possible situations that could happen on the field, and
right.
People, someone moves here and there, and that awareness has really helped him in hockey too.
So. Right, Wayne was saying it when he was a kid. Yeah. He thought he'd be a Major League Baseball player. You know,
yeah.
I mean,
he
you know, was pursuing that, but he said he was better at hockey. But you know, there's a common theme too as far as movement goes. You know, Federer, his movement is extraordinary. You know, McEnroe, his movement. He wasn't the biggest, strongest player, but he had that finesse. He had that mm-hmm. great movement and speed on the court, like Federer. You know, Gretzky, what isn't big, but he could move well. And you pointed out this in Search for Greatness. You showed some footage of this Brazilian soccer player. How do you pronounce his name?
Garrincha? Garrincha, yeah.
Oh, my God. The way that, just watching that guy in your film for a few seconds, his movement?
Yeah.
He had abnormal knees, right?
Yeah.
One knee was in, one knee was out.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the guy, I've never seen a guy move like that.
Yeah, I mean, he was one of the most creative soccer players in history, and he's kind of one of these guys that's unknown to kind of the modern generation.
Right.
But back then, in, like, let's say the 50s, he was, like, better than Pelé, even skill-wise. You know, he could do anything with the ball. He ended up becoming an alcoholic. But he was just, his talent was unreal.
And Pele said
even
he was
says
the greatest,
he was the greatest
athlete.
Player he'd ever
right.
played with and seen. And but he was crippled. Essentially, he was a guy that was, and there's a theme in the movie, you know, that was passed over, you know, in his youth because they just said, this guy, you know, he's got deformed legs. He's never going to make it. And he turns into the greatest football player ever,
right.
a soccer player. So it's, you know, a lot of these times, you know, theme in the movie, these weaknesses that these athletes seem to have turn out to be their greatest strengths, you
right.
know, because they realize that they can deceive people. And Garrincha's said, you know, no one could understand how this guy moved, you know, so they couldn't defend against him. He was just so, you know, so Gretzky was the same, where he talks about in the movie how, you know, it doesn't look like I'm fast. You know, everyone, if he were doing a 40 on the ice or one lap around the rink, he'd be one of the slowest guys. But it's that quickness and anticipation.
Right. It goes
that he's
with
actually
the mental
a lot
aspect.
It's called hockey speed or football speed.
Right.
You know.
And Jerry Rice, the same thing. I mean, he wasn't the fastest running a 40-yard dash, but on the football field, he knew how to maneuver so quickly. And, you know, I think another theme that you brought out so beautifully in Search of Greatness was the fact that, you know, you can't specialize too early. We talked about that in one sport. And that also, nowadays, everything's so structured and so analytical. Analytics. Mm. I can't stand that word. You know, everything, whether it's baseball, analytics, let's look at this guy's stats.
Yeah.
It's not about the stats.
About
there's so many intangibles
that I mean,
make
if we,
greatness.
If we don't go to the stadium to look at spreadsheets, you know, I think everyone can intuitively understand that we're looking for, we go to the stadium because we want to see something magical happen, beautiful and an incredible showmanship, you know, seeing, you know, Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, or whoever, name that guy, do something that you've never seen before. That's not in a stat sheet. That's
right.
About creativity. We want to see that artistry. That's why we go. That's why we pay money. That's why these guys make the big money. But the coaches are afraid of their jobs, you know, and so they're afraid of taking risks because they can't say, oh, I made this decision because I just felt that way intuitively. They have to show on a spreadsheet why they made that decision, or else they're afraid of getting fired, or they just don't even trust their own instincts,
right?
You know,
there's
because a lot of these guys, but a lot of the greatest players are guys that on a stat sheet don't look that attractive, is what I'm saying. And right. so it takes someone with incredible wisdom and
guts.
Intuition and guts to
right.
select a guy like that.
To take a risk. Exactly. Yeah, so and look at all of them. They took a risk with Tom Brady. They took a risk with Brett Favre. They took a risk yeah. with, you know, yeah. all these guys. Like Michael Jordan, you know, who his retirement speech was interesting.
Yeah.
He played based on that retirement speech to prove everybody wrong.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So his and I kind of said it last week, but basically, you know, I feature the thing that kind of says the most about Michael Jordan, I think, is his retirement speech. And he'll say it himself. I mean, he kind of lays it all on the line. This is what motivated him was just this deep-seated kind of almost revenge idea of the people in the past that didn't believe in him, that you know, it passed him over for whatever reason, and he just logs it in his brain, and that's what motivates him. I think we all can identify with that.
Right.
We remember people who didn't believe in us because,
right.
you know, and he was passionate about, beyond passionate about the sport and competitive, but it was that anger that drove him, and you could see it in his psychological.
Did that ever come out? I wonder
state,
during his career,
yeah.
Gabe. I mean, as far as
yeah.
interviews, I mean, just
well,
and
well,
him
not
voicing it.
Well, no, no, okay. So in his interviews, yeah. I think it's not attractive.
Sudden,
it's not an attractive quality to be doing that
right.
in an interview because people like people who are humble and
right.
you know because he'll get attacked. So I think he's smart enough to know that. Look, I can't be doing it. But on the court, if
right.
you ask any other player he played against.
That drove him.
Yeah, he would try and destroy them, you know, like psychologically,
right.
and it was like a dark force.
But to express all of this in his retirement speech to me, because he had this incredible career,
yeah.
but it really, I guess he was being very honest,
yeah.
very very revealing. That's what drove him to prove all those people.
But
he
went
through
every
single person.
But it's what drives not
person.
Just him, but it's. I think all of us to a certain yeah. degree. Yeah, we want to think that we're just like happy-go-lucky,
right.
you know, I just want to succeed. But oftentimes, like, it's that anger that drives a lot of people.
Right.
Look at all the successful, like, businessmen and,
right.
you
just
know,
tell
whoever.
Me
it's
you can't do it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it is. Then you prove them wrong.
Yeah, or they felt inferior when they were younger, and so it just, they want to prove to everybody that, you know.
Gabe Polsky is here with us. We were talking about In Search of Greatness. Now, that came out, what, about a year ago, right? In Search of
it
Greatness?
It came out in 2018, and I'm
okay.
still talking about it, A, because I'm incredibly passionate. I think that there's even a wider audience for the film. It was released
right.
theatrically, but now it's going to be on Amazon Prime, and
awesome.
It's on you know, all the platforms to rent. So
right.
it's sort of a, you know, with these films, with documentaries, you got to, you know, sometimes the audience... You reach them a little bit later
sure.
than the initial release, and so you got to. This is like one of my missions. This film, just how what it can do for I think parents, coaches, and athletes, and sort of how I think it sort of reframes how we understand sport and you know healthy experience in sport and how to get the most out of the experience.
Absolutely, because you know parents put so much pressure on their kids. There's such a pressure for conformity. When you
yeah.
look at the film and you look at Wayne Gretzky's father, he was so relaxed. He didn't put that kind of pressure on his kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he let his kid be creative. He let mm-hmm. He said to Wayne, "Go to the movies with your friends." And Wayne said, "No, Dad, I want to go out and play hockey." You
yeah,
know?
Yeah. That drive, it never. The truth is it never comes from pressure from the outside, from parents or whatever. You're never going to pressure your kid into being successful. You can't pressure somebody to love you or whatever. It has to come from inside that person, you know? So the greatest athlete of all time, nobody pushed them. Nobody had to push them. So the parents that push their kids, it's insane. All it does is do worse. For the athletes.
I love all the messages in the film, and I do agree it should be something, it should be required watching for, you know, at public schools, for assemblies, and, you know,
yeah.
and that
yeah,
kind of thing, and for parents
knowledge.
And coaches, and because a lot of the messages are very, very important. Let's talk about Red Penguins playing this weekend here at the Hamptons International Film Festival. We spoke a little bit about it last week, And just a fascinating, you know, look at really what was going on in the Soviet Union, you know, when communism ended and all of a sudden free market. And then you have this crazy marketing guy, Steve Warsaw, going over there and trying to make this team, the Red Penguins, you know, it's trying to sell it out amidst all this drama that's going on off the ice. What were your thoughts about just putting that one together?
It was just, you know, the Red Penguin story was just too crazy and unique to pass up. It's a story that I knew, first of all, it's a story that no one really knows about. I guess fortunately for me, but basically, you know, when the Pittsburgh Penguins bought this famous Red Army team, one of the greatest teams in history, because they were bankrupt in the 90s when Soviet Union collapsed, it was like this crazy time where anything could happen between U.S. and Russia, a very optimistic time. A lot of investment was flowing into Russia, and where communism was dead, and now was our chance to get along, you know. And the premise is insane. The Pittsburgh Penguins buy this Red Army team and go about trying to make it into the greatest show in Russia at the time, because, you know, all the Red Army players at that time in the early 90s had gone into the NHL. You know, Sergei Fedorov, Pavel Bure, you know, Fetisov, all these guys, and they were having tremendous success. But back in Russia, it was like a wasteland. And so the story is really, it's not even really a sports story. It's a story about cultural conflict and why our cultures are different, and what happened to Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. How does that relate to what's happening now? And how do what is our mentality psychologically, Americans, you know, and what are Russians' psychological kind of dispositions, and how did they get that way? And then when they interact in a business situation like this situation, the Russian Penguins in the 90s, you see even more clearly the differences, because it's like this business case study that's absolutely insane. This is a dark comedy.
It is a dark comedy. Yeah. And just what was the lawlessness that was going on in the underpinnings is just crazy.
Yeah, with the mafia and all so the crazy things. Happened? There was no laws then.
What's happened to this team? What happened to
basically, I'll ruin the end. Basically, when the Americans are driven out by the mafia, the team fell on hard times again, the Red Army team. And at that time, let's say in 1994, the KHL was in its very early stages, and when Putin came to power in the 2000s, he basically told all the oligarchs, he said, look, you guys, because the KHL isn't like really a financially viable league, you have to support hockey in Russia. You've got to buy a team. And so that's what happened, is the oligarchs started buying teams and basically financially sponsoring them. And then they're trying to kind of hold up that league until to this day.
And a lot of them came over here. Well, of course, the Russian who bought the Brooklyn Nets.
Well, not a lot. I mean, I don't know other oligarchs, but yeah. And I think he's selling that.
He already sold it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Crazy. Yeah. So tell me about yourself, Gabe. You were athlete growing up, you went to Yale.
Yeah.
Did you study film there? Or
I studied political science, and I didn't know anything about film until, honestly, like my senior year. I sort of realized that, you know, going into the minor leagues and trying to make it in the NHL was just, for me, I was more of a finesse player. It was just going to be not viable. I would get killed. So I just basically tried to figure out what, you know, I liked, and I felt I was always kind of a clowny guy a little bit, and I liked entertainment. My roommate was doing sketch comedy and improv, and I'd see him write all the time and make these videos. And honestly, that was just kind of an inspiring thing. And I said, well, what about this entertainment thing? Is this something I could do? And that's how it sparked, and then I just self-educated.
And what was your first film?
Well, we started as producers in LA, and so what that means is we looked for intellectual property and started developing it. And one of the first projects that we started developing was about Albert Einstein. We got the rights to the Einstein estate and Walter Isaacson's biography about Einstein, and we started developing that it much later, as a lot of things in Hollywood, like after 10 years, like was developed into a television series, like the show Genius.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it became. But that was one of the first things. But the first thing that was actually made was a movie called Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans, with Nicolas Cage and Werner Herzog directed. It's a wacky, crazy movie that we developed, and we had no idea that it was going to turn into this very strange film in New Orleans about a deranged cop. It's somewhat experimental. It's funny that was the first thing out of the gates, but we started that way and learned a little bit from Werner Herzog, and kind of eventually we made a documentary called His Way, which was on HBO, got nominated for an Emmy, about Jerry Weintraub and a Hollywood story. Very kind of cool and inspiring story, and fell in love with documentaries, and then kind of started making them as a director.
Documentaries more satisfying for you?
You know, I think one of the reasons I got into it was it's a little bit less expensive, let's say, than a feature film. It can be really costly, and if you make it for a budget, and I was interested in it. You know, I'm a political science major. I like factual stories. I like them just. I tend to watch more documentaries than feature films, and so I just thought I could do something really great, you know, if I made one, you know, and so I just tried it out, and the first movie was Red Army, and it turned out great. So
because you can combine your political science background,
yeah, and
interest,
sport,
and sport, yeah. you're doing both of your passions.
I am, yeah, but I want to get out of I want to show myself not just as a sports documentarian guy, you know. I really believe that. I have, you know, I don't want to be pigeonholed that way because I believe I have more, you know, to say than just that. But
well, you will.
But I think I have through Spore, you know, in that way. But
I mean, every film, well, the two that I've seen, it's, as you say, it's beyond sport, way beyond sport.
Yeah, yeah.
Red Penguins, right. And In Search of Greatness.
But sometimes the non-sport audience, well, I don't know.
I know it is hard when you have titles like that. You know, you get into a little niche. You know,
yeah.
People think, oh, it can't be. Like, you like this show. This show is called Sports Interview, but it's not always about sports.
Absolutely,
there is a connection to sports in most of my segments.
Yeah.
Certainly not in the first segment with the National Enquirer, although it's the media.
Right.
You know, and that's been my world for.
But then your audience
so
is probably primarily sports.
Not necessarily.
Audience,
I mean,
no?
I have women who come up to me regularly and say, "Ann, we're not sports people. We don't know anything about sports, but we love to hear your interviews."
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what's so great. Yeah. It has like more of a general appeal, you know. And I think, you know, for your film, In Search of Greatness, it speaks to diehard sports fans. It speaks to casual sports fans. It speaks to parents.
Yeah.
You know, how can my child grow up? You know, what are the qualities that contribute to greatness?
Yeah.
You know, how should I be as a coach, as a parent, you know, with having a kid that's very interested in sport? You know, so
yeah,
it speaks to all that.
When I screen my films, and I'm talking about my three documentaries, they're all sports related, right? I've never once screened them for sports fans because I already know that there's going to be inherent interest. But
right.
The only thing I care about is if people who don't know a thing about the subject that I'm doing to connect with it, to be engaged from the first moment to the last. And so the way I get feedback through my rough cuts is basically, you know, making sure that I can connect with people who don't have any interest in what I'm...
You wanted to transform sport.
Yeah, and I'm not like a rabid sports fan. You know, I like the experience of sport, the spirit of it. I love playing sports, but I'm not like a guy that watches a ton of sport.
Right, every baseball game.
Yeah,
every
or like
hockey
know what's
game.
Going on in the
right.
thing. I mean, I tune in. I like to see what's going on in the sport and how it's developing and how players are playing and who's great and why and stuff like that. But I'm not like a crazy sports. People might think I am because I've made these films.
Right, but everybody wants to know like what sets these personalities apart, whether they're athletes like a Wayne Gretzky or a Tiger Woods or a Serena Williams or an incredible businessman, you know, whether it's Bill Gates or whomever, what In Search of Greatness, what is it about these personalities? And we were, you know, talking a little bit about that creativity and not conforming and knowing what your weaknesses are and how to maneuver around those obstacles.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, the beauty of sport and in life is that you never, you don't look for the next greatest athlete, the next Gretzky, to be exactly like Gretzky, because he did his thing in his time and his way. You can't copy somebody. I think Kobe got pretty close to copying Jordan. He's great. He's one of the greatest athletes. But I think that you have to, the next greatness is going to be something totally unique.
Right. And
that's
LeBron
what the uniqueness
James.
Is. The same with the filmmaking. You don't copy other people's style, and because that's not great. You got to be
an original,
unique player, artist, whatever it is. That's what greatness is. So you shouldn't be. You should learn from the past, from other people, what they're doing, but the game's always changing too, and the rules and everything's changing. So you have to be fluid. You can't copy people. You have to. No history, learn it. The same with filmmaking. You don't need to know every film that was ever made, or you know what I'm saying? But
in search for greatness, yeah. Gabe, did you try to get Tiger and Serena to come on?
Yes, I did. Yeah. I tried to get them, specifically Serena. I went several times. In fact, IMG financed the movie, and Endeavor, IMG, they represent Serena. And I couldn't. I mean, no matter what, I just couldn't get a response. And then I found out later that she like right after I finished my film, she got involved with this documentary on HBO, I guess Being Serena or something, you know.
Oh,
so
I
was bummed because, you know, I didn't get a lot of time with these athletes. Yeah. I had to be really efficient.
Right.
You know, and all I needed was
a lot of time with Wayne.
No, I had an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So, but anyways, what I'm saying is I think you could do a lot with not too much time.
Well, those 500-plus sports interview TV shows that I've done, they are mostly live on tape.
Wow.
Because of the, as you mentioned, you don't get a lot of time with these personalities.
Yeah.
So it was like doing a live show because you had to get the material enough for a 30-minute show just like that.
And you have to assume that you're never going to see them again, you know.
Well, we could go on and on, and, you know, this is fascinating stuff for me, but Gabe, good luck with Red Penguins and this film festival this weekend, and so nice of you to kind of, you know, stop in and say hello.
We're like soul brothers, you know, like with our sports
soulmates.
Greatness.
We'll have to continue our conversation. And
soul sister.
Soul sister, brother, whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, Gabe Polsky, thank you so much for joining me, and Mark Landsman, producer director for Scandalous, and have a great weekend at the film festival. I'm going to go and see a few more films this weekend. And Gabe, hopefully we can continue our discussion about sport and philosophy and political science and everything else that you're into. Have a wonderful weekend. Kyle Lynch, thank you so much for your assistance this show, and we will talk to you next Saturday morning from 9 to 10 right here on Sports Interview with Anne Liguori. Have a great weekend, everybody.